Well, let's get started this morning. We're going to take a few weeks. I don't know how long this class is going to run. I haven't got it outlined yet. And I don't have a book that we're strictly following, so I'm not sure where this is going to go, but we're going to study Proverbs for a while. And I doubt it'll take less than 6 weeks. I doubt it'll take more than 10 or 12. So I think maybe by the end of the year we'll be done, maybe early January, something around those lines. And we're going to look at a lot of different things in the book of Proverbs, and maybe look at them in ways perhaps some of you haven't been exposed to. So what do you call a class? Proverbs just seems boring. So here's my official class title. That if anyone asks, this is what you can tell them, that this is an inquiry into the mystery, scope, style, and purpose of the book of Proverbs, written by Solomon, king of Israel, along with a few modest proposals and analysis with remarks gently made regarding the performance of our duties to the glory of God and the benefit of his people. So that's the subtitle of the class. All right, so we think about the book of Proverbs. Put forth this roadmap. Where do I think we're going to go? What's my intention right now? And I left these at a pretty high level so that I have maximum flexibility. So what are Proverbs? Well, first take a look at what is a proverb exactly and a little analysis of Proverbs. What role do they play in canon? I want to spend some time looking at the author, why it's important to think of Solomon as the author of Proverbs, the dedication and the purpose of the book, be the next part of the lessons. So the first three cover the first seven or so verses of chapter one, and I think we'll take two lessons for those. And then the My Son sections, this is part of the discourse Proverbs that take place over the first nine chapters. And so we're going to look at My Son sections, one after the other, and see what we can glean from them. And then once we get through chapter 9, from Proverbs 10 through chapter 29, there's some authorship questions we'll look at. And just for the record, that I believe Solomon is the author of Proverbs, with the exception of the last two chapters. But we'll look at the chapters 10 through 29 in a topical fashion. I don't want to address a particular topic in 10 and then come back and do it again in 12, and where it's repeated again in 14. So we'll look at it more topically. And then we'll look at the last two chapters to see what Agur and Lemuel say. They have different things they write in Proverbs. Their style is slightly different. And so what kind of goals do I have? That's where we're going. Those are the places we'll stop and take a look. But my first goal is to help you learn how to read Proverbs. I've been reading Proverbs for a very long time, and I've come to realize that I don't read them well. And so that's changed recently, and I'm grateful for that. And I thought I would help. Perhaps there are others who are having the same problem. To appreciate the art and craft of Proverbs, there's a lot in Proverbs in terms of craft that I had not seen, which should surprise no one. If you've spent any time reading poetry at all, you realize as you grow to understand what the author was trying to accomplish in particular work, some of it is really amazing, and the craft involved is very thoughtful. And Proverbs, the Hebrew poetry, is no less. And then the third lesson, the third goal that I have is to help you become holy. That's the goal. So if you guys know a lot about poetry and it doesn't seem interesting, well, that's fine. I don't have a lot to say on it. And if you still read a chapter a day of Proverbs, if that's a goal you set and you want to do that, that's fine too. I'm not going to complain about that. And if you've got nothing else to learn, I hope your desire to be holy will be invigorated through this class, because that really is the goal of Proverbs. So let's take a look at the first opening exercise with just one sentence. One sentence only, please. How would you describe your experience with the Book of Proverbs so far? Some of you have been reading it for a long time. Some of you maybe not as often or as frequent, but give me a one-sentence summary of your experience and understanding of the Book of Proverbs.
Pity the fools.
Pity the fools, that's right. Yeah, that's right. I pity the fools. That's actually insightful, by the way. Even if you haven't seen Mr. T. That's it. God's wisdom, make you happy. That's right. What else?
Proverbs is not like a story. It doesn't mean like you read a book of Ruth, it's like a story.
Mm-hmm.
But Proverbs is like everything mixed together.
That's right. Yeah, it is. It's and that's that can be difficult to read at times, yeah, as you're jumping around a lot. Yeah.
It's a place to go to be convicted.
Place to be convicted. Okay. I didn't anticipate that. That's good.
Desire of wisdom.
To desire wisdom. Okay. What else?
I often found I profited more by reading just a few proverbs than trying to read the entire chapter. Because I get overwhelmed with too much.
Sure. Sure. I'm like a pendulum when it comes to the quantity of Proverbs. For many, many years, I read a chapter of Proverbs a day. So you read through it once a month, and it was great. And I memorized and learned a lot of Proverbs. And through this class, I thought, that's just terrible. I shouldn't do that anymore. And then I go back and say, well, you know, broad exposure is not a bad thing. So I don't know where the pendulum's at right now. But for the time being, I'm not a chapter a day guy. That could change though before the end of class.
Well, you know, David, the Proverbs say that man should be steady and not swing.
That's right. Yep. What else? Who else has an observation? Yeah, Dan.
For me, I guess they're both challenging and inspiring. Kind of what I heard say. There's, I mean, the Proverbs, and kind of think, wow, this is impossible. But then at the same time, it's very inspiring that they.
Yep.
Kind of both.
Sure. What else? What other one sentence type thoughts about Proverbs? Adam?
I see Proverbs as a letter from a father to a son, urging him to, among other things, but one of the main themes is to be careful in his life choices.
A theme of a letter from a father to a son to be careful in life choices. That's good. Anybody else?
Thanks.
Go ahead, John.
I was going to say, it defines the fear of the Lord.
Defines the fear of the Lord. Okay, that's good. Yeah. Sam?
Along the lines of the pursuit of wisdom, it gives you some just kind of practical ideas of what that looks like. Pursuing.
Maybe more actually than that.
Okay, good.
Shows what the fear of the Lord looks like.
Yeah.
A timeless, practical guidebook to holiness.
That's good.
Timeless. I always feel like that's one of the main books that it doesn't matter what point in the time period you are.
Mm.
The core is there, and it's, I find it a lot easier to relate.
Sure.
To that book.
Sure. It's easy to relate to. I agree. Any other one-sentence observations about the Book of Proverbs?
It's a book of one sentences.
It's a book of one sentences. It's a book of many one sentences. That's right. Yeah. All right. Anybody else before we move on? Susanna, are you raising your hand? Get Dad's attention. Okay. All right. Good. Okay. Well, let's move on then. some of what provoked this study, I thought I'd share these titles with you. Maybe the most influential one that took me off high center was this God's Wisdom in Proverbs by Dan Phillips, which I found to be a remarkable book. Very, very well done. And written from a very different, in a very different style. And he pushed me to think about Proverbs a little differently. And I benefited terrifically from the book. So some of the more choice quotes and some of the observations and some of the layout I'll be following from Phillips' book. Then there's a book by Francis Taylor from 1655, an exposition of the practical observations upon the first three chapters of Proverbs. There's also this attempt upon an improved translation of the Proverbs of Solomon by George Holden. That's helpful as well. Not as helpful, but it is helpful. So I have the Phillips book. It's not available for loan until after the class is done, but the other books are freely available out on the web. You don't need a physical copy. There's also Charles Bridges in the Geneva series of that Banner Truth publishes, which is considered a standard in Proverbs. And then one that's maybe not as well known, but is practical, and the word practical is a little hard to use in the book of Proverbs, but it's not written in a typical commentary fashion. It's William Arnett's illustrations on the book of Proverbs. He doesn't exegete each proverb in a commentary sort of way. He takes some and draws some analysis from it. It's very readable. I picked up Arnott a couple decades ago, read it and was helped by it, and picked it up again recently and found some helpful things. So those are the resources that I'm currently using for this series, and I think you would be helped by any of them. And if you've got questions about these, let me know. I'll send you some links. So let's take a little, before we get into Proverbs in particular, step back for just a minute and find that Proverbs is in a section of the Bible called wisdom literature. So the wisdom literature books are typically identified as Job's and Psalm and Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. So one question I have for you is, what are some of the notable characteristics of each of these books? When you think of Job, what characteristics of the style of writing comes to mind when you think of Job? It's conversational. That's right. Conversational. Yeah. Anything else?
And philosophical.
It's philosophical.
It's a lamentation.
Lamentation. Yep. Poetic. Yep. There's some bad analysis in there. Yeah. Some bad philosophy. Yeah, that's right. How about Psalms? What characteristics of style come to mind when you think of Psalms?
It's poetry. You go to music.
Metrical.
Okay. Metrical.
Emotional.
Yeah. How about Ecclesiastes? What comes to mind when you think of Ecclesiastes?
Vanity of vanities,
yeah. But thinking more of style, when you read Ecclesiastes, what does the style strike you as?
Partly a memoir.
Partly a
memoir.
Yeah.
Searching and exhaustive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. What else?
Philosophy of life.
Philosophy of life in poetic form. That's good.
It's a bit more of a narrative than just a collection.
A little more narrative, right? Instead of just a collection, okay?
Sometimes the meaning is hard to find in some of the passages.
Yeah.
Be a little cryptic.
It can be cryptic and the meaning is hard to find. I'm glad you said that. It's important. What about Song of Songs? It's a love song, yeah. What else?
Job, but it's very different.
It does. Multiple characters, that's right. Yeah. There's multiple characters in it.
All of these books include emotions. Maybe more so than any other book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right, emotional. Yep.
They're all less story books. And not really telling stories. Maybe Joe, but...
Yeah, there's not as much narrative, not as much story, which is the next question. How does wisdom literature differ from other books in the Bible? So how would you compare the style of the Song of Solomon or the Song of Songs with the Gospel of Luke or Acts? What comes to mind? Sure.
Which also philosophical or theological in nature. But Paul's letters are there more like reasoned tracts on a certain subject without so much imagery. So
for the sake of the recording, there is quite a bit of difference, and I'm trying to summarize what you were saying, with something like the Gospel of Luke, but comparing it to one of Paul's epistles, it would also be very different, where Paul's more reasoned, more almost tract-like. It's a letter. Should never forget, Paul wrote letters. They were meant to be heard. They're meant to be read in whole. The imagery is not as obscure. It's more direct. Yes, that's it. Any other differences? So some books are far softer in their persuasive technique than Paul. Is that a fair summary?
Sure.
Yeah, which is true. Yeah.
On the other hand, the meaning of the symbolism in the wisdom literature, it's less obscure than the prophetic books of the Bible.
Yeah.
So
there may be degrees of difficulty in unraveling the symbolism between Paul's epistles, the wisdom literature, and some of the prophetic literature. You know, trying to figure out what the myrtles have to do in Zechariah is an ongoing life mystery for me. Yeah, Terry.
Perhaps tied in with it being poetic, it's these poetical books seem to be aiming a lot at the emotion.
So
and
the
people can say, well, you know, it's always wrong to aim at the emotion, not always.
Yeah, that's right. It's not. It's not wrong to aim at the emotion, and wisdom literature does do that. That's right. That's right. Not exclusively. You know, none of these are attributes that are exclusive to one genre or the other. Let me give you a few other ideas of differences and some observations. Most of the wisdom literature tends to be pretty short on the history of God's people as a plural. The wisdom literature tends to focus on an individual or a small group, but not necessarily the collective people. That's not completely true. So you get in some of the Psalms, and David laments about people collectively. But as a rule, Job isn't Exodus. So there's a difference. Prophecies play almost no real role in the wisdom literature to speak of. It's not a significant one anyway. Law giving and ceremony are also items that you do not find found and expanded upon in wisdom literature. The miraculous is also sparse or practically non-existent in wisdom literature. You don't find the prophets coming or like the apostles performing works and miracles. Observations about people and daily life play a very significant role in wisdom literature. Wisdom literature generally contains more poetry than prose. metaphor and simile, as is in the case with prophecy, is also a major component. And deep-hearted, solemnly felt emotion are often expressed throughout wisdom literature. So when we look at when we look at the category of literature that we're encountering, it's important to remember Dan. Where's Dan when you need him? He doesn't have his assault gun, does he? That fly-killing apparatus of his. But it's important to remember that wisdom literature is part of the canon, and that it does share some things in common with Zechariah or Luke or the Book of Acts or the Epistle to the Ephesians, and that is a common authorship. So God is the author of the wisdom literature books, and we shouldn't forget that. Because it's a different style altogether than maybe what we're accustomed to frequently reading. It also has a common purpose. It pushes forward the narrative of the redemption and the fall, the redemption, the glorification of man, the plight of man, evil, envy, discontentedness, glory. These are all things found in wisdom literature, but not expressed the same way as in other books. And perhaps a bit unappreciated as a reminder that these varied styles that we find throughout biblical literature, in my mind, lead to an authentic whole. And what I mean by that is, if the Bible were merely Paul's epistles, or they were merely the history of God's people, there wouldn't be much variety to that, right? You wouldn't see God utilizing men to write his word if they only wrote one way. And so this elaborate mix of styles, I think, is very important for all of us to be convinced that God's word is God's word. It contributes to the authenticity of the Bible having a common author and a common purpose. So, how does Proverbs fit within the larger canon? Well, let's look at Hebrews 1, verses 1 through 4. God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the worlds, who, being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person, and upholding all things by the word of his power, when he had by himself purged our sins, sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become so much better than the angels, as he has by inheritance obtained a more excellent name than they. It's a beautiful passage of really the history of the canon and the history of redemption bound up into one. And I want to draw your attention to just these two sets of highlighted phrases at various times in various ways. What do we mean by that? Well, we mean that God didn't say the same thing the same way just one time. God said what he had to say through different people, through different ways. And wisdom literature fits within this portrait perfectly. So God spoke is the subject and the verb that we need to have as preeminently understood in the opening of Hebrews 1. But various times in various ways are also helpful to remember that this literature that we're about to study is an important piece of literature. All right, so I'd like to remind you that it really is a lot easier to read read the Bible and to focus on those narratives that have what I would call maybe lists of information, you know, that Jesus was here and then on the next day he went over here or took a three-day journey or the prophet was in this part of the country and he went here. Proverbs, among all the wisdom literature, has its own genre to it, which is largely past chapter 9, couplet poetry, Hebrew poetry, two-line couplets, that are hard to understand at times. And certainly some aspects require a lot more thinking than other aspects do. I mean, not all proverbs within themselves are equally understandable, but Proverbs, given the whole of wisdom literature, is not on the same par. They require slightly different skill sets. So the first thing I'd like to do is to define what we mean by proverb. And by the Hebrew word that we're translated proverb is mashal, and it has several usages and is not limited to the title or the contents of the book of Proverbs. So one of the ways that we see it defined is a proverbial saying or an aphorism, and an example of this. And I'm not 100% convinced that these examples line up perfectly with the description being offered. And to really understand some of these passages, you need a larger context, but I didn't want to put the whole context there, so I make a note of these things so you can go back and look at them. So you'll find in Ezekiel 17:2, and the word of the Lord came to me saying, "Son of man, pose a riddle and speak a parable to the house of Israel and say, thus says the Lord," and on it goes. So God is instructing Ezekiel as a prophet to employ parables or to employ riddles here. How about a byword? When we find God speaking to Solomon in 1 Kings 9:7, he says, "But if you or your sons at all turn from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes which I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, and this house which I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight. Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all peoples." So here's another way we find this word being used. Similitude or parable, which has a similar meaning to what we were finding up in verse in the A definition. For in 1 Samuel 10:12, "Then a man from there answered and said, 'But who is their father?'" This is as they were evaluating Saul. "Then it became a proverb, 'Is Saul also among the prophets?' And when he had finished prophesying, he went to the high place." So if someone were to say, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" What would he mean by that? What would be the purpose of that proverb listed in Samuel there? What does it mean?
Somewhat unbelieving. This is hard to believe that even Saul, because that's not his general characteristic.
Right. An unlikely event, perhaps, happening to an individual that we would where an individual is being raised above his station, so it would become a proverb. So Ezekiel 24:3, "Again in the 9th year in the 10th month, on the 10th day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me saying, 'Son of man, write down the name of this day. This very day the king of Babylon started his siege against Jerusalem, this very day, and utter a parable to the rebellious house and say to them, thus says the Lord.'" So God speaks in parables. This should be no surprise. But he did so outside of Solomon and his reign. We find the word mashal can also mean poem. So we find in Numbers 21, this is a long passage. I decided not to show the whole thing, but to a short excerpt here. "Then Israel sent messengers to Sihon, king of the Amorites." They were wandering in the wilderness, and they needed to get over here, saying, "Let's pass through your land." And they didn't allow it. Sihon said no. The Amorites said no. Israel went after them, devoured them with the sword. "Therefore, those who speak in Proverbs say, 'Come to Heshbon, let it be built. Let the city of Sihon be repaired.' For fire went out from Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon. It consumed Ar of Moab, the lords of the heights of Arnon. Woe to you, Moab, you have perished. O people of Chemosh, he has given his sons as fugitives and daughters in the captivity to Sihon, king of the Amorites. But we have shot at them. Heshbon has perished as far as Dibon. Then we laid waste as far as Nophah, which reaches to Medeba." So you don't have to be a highly trained biblical scholar to see in verses 28 through 30 that that's obviously poetic. You can imagine if somebody, John, I'll ask you, you probably have the most direct experience. If someone reported an after-action write-up report to their commander in the style of verses 28 to 30, how would that have been received by high central command? Requiring a bit more explanation, perhaps? That's right. So This is an after-action military report, but it's written in poetic style or in mashal style. And the fifth meaning of this word are sentences of ethical wisdom or ethical maxims, and you find many instances of this in the book of Proverbs itself. So that we're going to spend some time looking at that and not finding particular definitions. So we have these definitions of proverbs, but what is a proverb? What does the word proverb mean? And this is going to be our working definition. If you have a better one, bring it on and we'll adapt it. But a proverb is a compressed statement of wisdom, artfully crafted to be striking, thought-provoking, memorable, and practical. This comes from Dan Phillips in the book I mentioned earlier, God's Wisdom in Proverbs. A proverb is a compressed statement of wisdom, artfully crafted to be striking, thought-provoking, memorable, and practical. So, off the top of my head, I was thinking about characteristics of a proverb. If someone says, what are some of the things that you would see when you're looking at a proverb? And terse, packed, dense, pithy, memorable.
It's like a haiku.
It's like a haiku, that's right. Relevant, practical, comprehensible, repeatable are all things that came to mind. Regarding the attributes or the characteristics of proverbs. Can you think of any others? Any other thoughts come to mind?
Tweetable.
Tweetable. Not in the strict technical sense, but yes. After chapter 10, you're tweetable. My sons are probably not.
Pictorial?
Yeah. Graphic, maybe. To the point, brief. What else?
Might be close to relevant, but sometimes like kind of acontextual. They don't really have it. They can stand on their own, I guess.
They stand on their own, that's right. That's actually a very important point we're going to look at later. It's the translation of interpretation of Proverbs. That's right. Any other attributes? This seemed like a good list. Okay, good. All right. Can't see that just yet. were proverbs, maybe a better way to put it, unique to the Jews? No, that's right. They're not. So every culture has proverbs. So, for instance, look before you leap, right? That's a well-known English proverb. If at first you don't succeed, what? That's right. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. Oh, it's all proverbs. That's right. Everybody. Don't change horses in the middle of the stream. That's right. That's right. But proverbs lend themselves to this short, compressed, repeatable, tweetable, visual. I can understand it. I may not comprehend its nuance, but it's there. Look before you leap. I can see that. But they're also can be easily given over to visual aids. So I found some I thought were interesting. Without reading the caption at the bottom, I wanted to put it up there. What does that look like? What do you see in that picture?
Falling into the gutter.
It's a little hard from back there. But apparently, every person has a different ophthalmological condition where each of them have something wrong with their eyes. So this is a visual parable of the blind leading the blind by Peter Bruegel in 1568. It's a beautiful picture.
That's based on a verse from the Bible.
It is, but... There were a couple of different Bruegels, and Bruegel also has a painting called the Proverb or something, the Dutch Proverbs. I don't remember what it's called, where it's a large picture where there are all the characters exhibit some sort of proverb. And I don't remember if this comes from that. I mean, it's a large one. You look and you can see this guy sitting around the corner is exhibiting this proverb, and they're not limited to biblical proverbs. There, who will bell the cat is one that was in there. So, it's interesting. I don't remember if this came from that or this was separate. I don't remember for sure. All right, here's a goofy looking one, but it's an important one. Big fish eat little fish. So, the blind leading the blind, I'm sure you all know, but what is big fish eating little fish? Especially if you look at this picture, and this was not the original. This is somebody else doing his own.
If you catch a big fish, you get a bunch of little fish.
If you catch a big fish, you get a bunch of little ones. That's right. That's part of it, I guess. What else? Hey, you know, there's a lot going on. So it looks like we've got some flying fish. And this guy is over here is fishing. There's a fish caught way up here. I'm not sure, but I think this clam is eating a fish. He has high aspirations. This guy is extracting a fish from the fish that he pulled into the boat. And I don't know what he's trying to explain to this person as he points off over here. Obviously, this fish was lucky at one time and got a bunch of these fish. And these fish were all lucky at one time, and they have their fish. But now this guy's got the largest serrated knife I've ever seen. He's making an end. And this guy is hauling fish to dry up here. And
that guy carrying a fish, or is he a fish?
Well, this guy's carrying a fish, but this guy over here, I'm not quite sure. He's got the legs of a man, a body of a fish, eating a fish. So
it's like that Darwin fish.
It's like a Darwin fish. That's
like
right.
That one little thing right there just makes it seem as creepy.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing is a bit odd.
It's obvious. You are what you eat.
You are what you eat. You are what you eat. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're welcome. Well, if you think that one was odd, wait till you see the next one. All right. This is really strange. So this is a Yiddish proverb that says, if grandma had a beard, she'd be a grandpa.
You know, that's wisdom we need today.
And the meaning underneath it said, wishing can't change anything. It's pointless to speculate about counterfactual situations. And I thought this might be the only time in recorded history that somebody might bring up the phrase counterfactual situations in a book of Proverbs. It struck me as an odd Yiddish proverb. If grandma had a beard, she'd be a grandpa. Well, obviously.
What is the context of saying that?
Oh, I don't, there is no context. That's the point. It's a problem. It doesn't need a context. But that's what it says.
Yeah.
If grandma had a beard, she'd be a grandpa. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, I thought that might be enjoyable. I've got a couple more serious points, and then I want to spend a little time on interpreting Proverbs. So, you look at things like this, and you can see what Proverbs can be funny, and some of the Proverbs Solomon wrote can be funny, but let me read this quote to you about interpreting Proverbs in general. The first challenge is the generally elusive nature of wisdom literature itself. Like the parables, the intended truths are often veiled from understanding if given only a cursory glance, and thus must be pondered in the heart. As I've been working through Proverbs with sort of a reinvigorated sense, I've really found this to be true, that I need to spend much, much, much more time thinking about each proverb than I had been. I've been memorizing them, and I've been thinking about them, but not really thinking about them in a way they need to be treated.
One of my favorite proverbs is, it's the glory of God to hide a thing. Glory of the king to find it out.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that is our task. That is precisely our task. But there's another problem with interpreting Proverbs, and that is, as John mentioned, that they are often without a context, but it goes beyond that, and that Proverbs really are relative in nature. Now, I don't want it to say that all truth is relative. That's not what I'm saying, but Proverbs have a limited scope of applicability. So they are not inviolable laws. They're observations. And they're maxims that are created from those observations. So let's look just a bit about interpreting Proverbs. Proverbs 10:27 says, "The fear of the Lord prolongs days, but the years of the wicked will be shortened." Well, do the righteous always live a long life? No, they don't. Do the wicked always die young? No, they don't. You know, sometimes the righteous are cut short. Sometimes the wicked see many, many days given to them. Length of days, right? And what do you do in a situation like that? Do you think, well, that proverb must not be true? Well, no, you can't do that. The proverb is true, that generally speaking, the fear of the Lord does prolong our days, and the years of the wicked are shortened. Now, oftentimes, the years of the wicked are shortened because they do things that just get them into trouble. So when we look at the book of Proverbs, when we look at interpreting Proverbs and try to come up, fashion some rules, I want you to understand that what is contradiction in a proverb, based on our observations and the observations of the poet, that these contradictions, as they appear, should be embraced as a feature and not a bug. It's not a shortcoming of Proverbs to say the Lord, the fear of the Lord, prolongs days, but the wicked will be shortened. Even though we can point to any number of instances where that's not true. That's not a problem. That's a feature. And we need to remember that. And the idea of contradiction, in my mind, gives greater weight and not lesser weight to the authority of Scripture, especially in Proverbs. Because in every other culture, no one treats Proverbs as some inviolable rule or law that God has established, right? They don't. Nobody treats Proverbs that way. And we shouldn't either. And when we come to biblical Proverbs, we shouldn't either. But we should remember that these were the observations, the divinely inspired observations of the wisest man who walked the earth next to Jesus. That's Solomon. We're going to look a little bit more at the author, the person, the context next week. But this is what we need to remember about Proverbs, is that the contradictions we see are features and not bugs. Let's look at just a few contradictory Proverbs. Look before you leap. He who hesitates is lost. Are either of those ever false? Well, sure. Yeah. If at first you don't succeed, try again. Or don't beat your head against a stone wall. Absence makes the heart grow fonder, but out of sight, out of mind. I sound like Tevye now. Never put off till tomorrow what you can do today. Don't cross that bridge until you get to it. Two heads are better than one. Paddle your own canoe. Many hands make for light work. Too many cooks spoil the broth. Haste makes waste. Time waits for no man. You're never too old to learn. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. A word to the wise is sufficient. Talk is cheap. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Beware of Greeks bearing gifts. Hitch your wagon to a star. Don't bite off more than you can chew. Don't judge a book by its cover. Clothes make the man. A squeaking wheel gets the grease. Silence is golden. Now, I'm sure all of you at some time have thought about both sides of these proverbs, but not in the same circumstance. In that particular situation, that proverb seemed appropriate. But in this situation, this proverb seems appropriate. And that's the nature of Proverbs. It's a feature and not a bug. Yes?
From it, and your child, and they take it as a promise that is going to be the case for everybody.
Yeah, we're actually going to spend a lot of time on that particular proverb in the weeks to come. Yeah, Proverbs 22:6. All right, so I want to leave you with one more thought about Hebrew poetry. And we've looked at sort of the general thought of what a proverb is. It's this compressed statement. It's dense, it's packed, it's tight, it's artfully crafted. We'll spend time looking at the craft as I can find it in the book of Proverbs, that it communicates something memorable, repeatable, something you can understand. But when we think of Hebrew poetry, we need to shift our thinking, because English poetry is not like Hebrew poetry. This is not a comprehensive guideline, but it's a generalization that we'll use in this class. English poetry tends to rhyme words. Hebrew poetry tends to rhyme or develop thoughts. And that's really important as we study Proverbs, that for us, having rhyming meter is very important. It contributes to the way we memorize things. It contributes to our understanding. It shows how clever people are. But and that's good, because that's a poet and a craft. But with Hebrew poetry, it's not that way. First of all, it's not in English. And to translate Hebrew into English rhyming meter is very, very difficult. It hasn't been done very well. But you can see the Psalter is an attempt at that, and it's very difficult to do, and takes years and years to publish a new Psalter. But what we need to understand in this class is that English poetry tends to find its rhyming pattern in words, but Hebrew poetry wants to rhyme and develop thoughts. Now, I don't want you to walk away thinking that the rhyming of thoughts is merely a repeat or an echo of the thoughts. Hebrew poetry tends to expand upon the thought. The rhyme is contained within the two thoughts, but as the rhyme develops, the thought develops as well. As the poem is extended, the rhyme is extended, the development is extended. So we shouldn't look for echoes, we should look for development. We should look for the rhyming of thoughts, not the rhyming of words.
I've also observed, I'm not sure if you agree with this, but I also observed that sometimes verses in Proverbs will develop it with a contrast.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
The fool does this, the wise man does this, and so, you have the development with the opposite of the contrast.
That's right. There are a lot of contrasting ones. And let me just give one outline about approaching Proverbs and poetry in general. At first, I thought I'd collect all of these rules about Hebrew poetry and methods for interpreting and how you look at them. And then we just work our way through the book and then point back to all the methods. And I decided not to do that. So instead, what we'll do is, as we work our way through and there's some element of craft or some distinguishing mark, this is how we identify it's proverb type A, this is a type B, this is type C. We'll identify those characteristics as we move through the book rather than learn them all up front and then try to find them. We'll learn them as we go through. So some of them will take quite a while to actually develop before we get to them, but others will come soon. All right, we're running a bit over, but any questions or observations?
I was just noticing that as you're bringing out these different points, it reminds me of learning styles. I certainly worked on understanding that with my kids. Different kids need different emphasis. One needs to be able to make a picture in their head, one needs to be able to read the words, one needs to be able to put it into action. And of course, when you kind of combine all these things, it helps really solidify it in mind.
I agree. That's right. I think Proverbs is an excellent example of many of those characteristics being bound together. Yeah. Any other questions? Jeff.
Task for human beings to learn how to apply Proverbs.
You're right. This is a lifelong endeavor. You're not going to walk out of here feeling like, man, now I understand. No, I hope when you walk out of here, you're holier than you were, but also that you think I can begin work on this myself.
Just now occurred to me, I've only read it probably 6 million times, still kind of, and I just had a new way of looking at it, just standing right here today, even though I've been through that many times, we just went through a study, you still every once in a while could look and go, well, wait, maybe it should be interpreted this way. You just never know, and sometimes you maybe a little bit more progress to understand.
That's right. Yeah, it happens. That's right. Any other thoughts before we close? All right, let's pray.